afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'll open the House Committee on Revenue, and we're going to go ahead and open some public hearings today. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2033. Madison?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Today we have, a portfolio of new Treasury bills with no reference to liquidity. The House Bill 2033, what it does basically, it allows the Treasurer to reorganize some of the details of the way they get funds and institutions that do take public funds into different requirements under the threshold of $100,000 or not. So if that threshold has not been reached, then the requirements need to be less since those funds are insured anyhow. But if they do, they actually are put into a collateral type of deposits and accordingly worked in the old way. However, from the look of your copy of the bill, you would see how these changes are taken from one place and reintroduced into Section 2 of the bill for that threshold and above. And then finally, it takes certain exemptions of the other public funds, such as county debt and investments, out of these requirements for percentage reserve into the accounts. In that way, Mr. Chair, the bill does not have a revenue impact since it really just deals with how you administer public funds rather than get any new, and accordingly also does not have any fiscal impact.
Thank you very much, Ms. We'll go ahead and ask Darren Bond to come up, if you would, please, Darren. Darren, I'd like you to take us through this section at a time, explaining why we've got language in Section 1 drawing out State Treasurer furnishing reports and over in Sections 3, some language on the credit unions, and Section 4 regarding the bond sinking fund, the clarification of the relationship with the holding banks. If you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2033 makes a number of technical changes to ORS 295, the Public Funds Collateralization Statutes. While many of the changes deal with the organization of the statutes, and I'll go through those, I'll mostly address the substantive issues of the bill. The biggest change in the bill is found in Section 3.3. The language corrects an existing inconsistency. As a matter of prudent fiscal management, the state requires financial institutions that accept public funds deposits in excess of the $100,000 insured amount to enter into collateralization agreements with the treasurer and a custodian bank. The purpose of these arrangements is to provide protection against the loss of funds in the event of a default on the part of a financial institution holding public funds. However, current law also requires that financial institutions holding public funds deposits that do not exceed the $100,000 insured amount enter into these same agreements. Since these smaller deposits are covered by insurance, the agreements are pointless. And they result in the institutions and Treasury incurring unnecessary costs and inefficiencies to manage the process. This change will allow the institution that holds deposits under insurance limits to do so without the unnecessary burden of entering into the agreements. Section 4 of the bill takes language currently found in ORS 295.005, paragraph 6, and clarifies it. It also eliminates a conflict that exists currently between ORS chapters 294 and 295. This conflict relates to local government deposits or local government investments and time deposits. In Chapter 294, time deposits are included in the list of authorized investments for local governments. Chapter 295 excludes authorized investments from the collateralization protections provided in that chapter. At the same time, 295 addresses certificates of deposit in other parts of the chapter. This change clarifies the deposits are that time deposits of local governments are subject to the provisions of ORS Chapter 295. While this is reflective of current practice, it places the public official on firmer legal ground should the institution be placed into receivership and the FDIC elect to question the validity of existing collateralization agreements. This change is found in paragraph 2 of that section. In section 4.1, there are two clarifications made. The first is in subsection B, and it's at the request of the Department of Justice to accurately reflect the flow of investment dollars through the state's custodian bank. The custodian typically plays an administrative role more than an investment role, and this change reflects that. The second change is in subsection C, which clarifies that negotiable certificates of deposit are not subject to this chapter. Negotiable CDs are actively traded money market instruments, generally issued by large money center banks and often a component of a short-term cash portfolio like the Oregon Short-Term Fund. Because of the similarity in names, it's important to clarify the distinction between a negotiable and a standard certificate of deposit. Relative to the movement of or the deletion of language in Section 1, this was Ledge Council's attempt to better organize the statutes. So they've taken this language and moved it out and consolidated it, and that language can be tracked through and found in Section 3 of the bill. So there's been no substantive eliminations. It's just a consolidation and a reorganization the Ledge Council thought would make the statutes flow more readily.
Thank you, Darren. Are there questions of Darren from the Treasurer's Office? Pam, can we ask you to come forward? Pam Levitt signed in on behalf of the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Pam, you had legislation, I believe it was in 2003, that is addressed here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Yes, Mr. Chairman, last session we passed Senate Bill 331, which will allow state-chartered and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon to accept public deposits. Previously, that was not allowed in the statute. In our negotiations with the bill, we limited the deposits at $100,000. And in working with the Treasurer's Office, we found that this requirement for a custodian over $100,000 was still being required, even though our credit unions were not going to accept any amounts over $100,000. So we support this bill, and you have my testimony, and be happy to answer any specific questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Pam on behalf of the Oregon Credit Association Credit Union? Darren, I want you to tell me that relative to the Section 4, none of the local government investment pool is placed at risk here. There's no additional risk or additional cost, additional administration by some consolidations here?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. Are there other questions of either of these two witnesses? Anyone else have anything to come forward in public session, public hearing, on behalf of 2033? We'll close the hearing, public hearing on 2033. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2033. Colleagues, it's my proposal that we move House Bill 2033 to the full House of Representatives with a due pass representation. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, I'll make that motion that we forward it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves that House Bill 2033, as presented, move to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. For the record, Representative Comp is not present for that vote. Representative Esquivel, would you carry that to the full floor, please?
Love to.
Thank you very much. And Laura, I apologize. Laura, you were ready up here, and I had you on my agenda just before 2041, but I noticed that you've got some slides and are ready to go. So we'll invite Laura to come forward and on behalf of the Treasurer's Office and tell us about state debt policy and debt management practices. Riveting information. Drop the temperature 5 degrees.
Better do 10 today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of Debt Management in the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. Look at my
desk. Thank you, Chair. We need to be in a public hearing for the background on the bill.
Okay. This is really not subject to any bill. I thought it was informational. This will be on 41. Okay, 2041. Why don't we go ahead and do that? We'll open a public hearing on 2041. And if you want to switch over to that, I'm sorry, Laura, I was going to, again, continue on, but we will go ahead and start in as a public testimony on 2041 and get out of order just a little bit.
It's okay. I can't quite get my presentation up and running yet, so
you can
buy me some time.
Lunge into it.
I'll be shared the podium by Kate Richardson and Cynthia Burns.
Mr. Chair, are you going to hear the testimony in 2041, or are you wanting the background?
Well, we'll get the background from Laura, if we could. Why don't we do this? Why don't we go ahead and see. The only person I had down for 2041 was Laura. I'm sorry. I stampede to apologize.
In the background.
Okay.
So if you do it under a public hearing, then you can ask about public information.
Okay.
So do it under that. This background is related.
Okay, you're right. Legislative Revenue Officer tells me that we are not posted for any background hearing, that this is all public testimony regarding the House Bill 2041. So, Kate, this is in part your show. Do you want to go ahead and give us your information, and then we'll turn to Laura and have her talk to us about debt from the Treasury in total?
Even though you want to go to the chair, this would be background for this bill.
Okay.
Under our record.
Okay. So what I'm going to do, remain open for 2041 for background on a public hearing on 2041. Okay. Okay, and we'll go to Laura.
Mr. Chair, just so we're sure that we all understand, Laura's presentation is a general background on debt, and then my testimony will be on House 2041. So
right.
Your choice, which one goes first?
Let's do this. Let's come back, and we'll do Laura with regard to the debt.
Okay.
And then, and all within the scope of 2041, we'll continue on with you, Kate.
Okay, we're going to sit back during her presentation then. Thank you.
You're welcome to do that.
Take my look at the screen. Thank you for buying me 30 seconds to boot up the computer.
Go ahead, Laura.
Thank you. I'm here today just to give you a broad overview of the various types of debts that are issued by the state of Oregon. And please stop me if I'm talking too fast or talking concepts that are foreign to you. I'll try as best I can to speak in layperson's language, but to give you the framework of how I look at debt and how the rating agencies that rate our debt look at it. So my goal would be, first of all, to summarize the findings of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. That's a commission made up of the state treasurer, two members of the legislature, a private citizen, and it reviews each year the state's debt capacity and the overall plan of where we're headed with debt. I hope to give you this analytical framework to evaluate our debt position, and lastly, to assist you as best I possibly can in formulating future capital spending plans that might involve the use of debt. The first thing is that there's not one type of debt. There's actually a variety of different types of debt instruments that are used in the state. General obligation bonds, which probably many are most familiar with, require voter approval, because each time we actually do those types of bonds, there's a constitutional amendment associated with it under state law. It does pledge the full faith and credit of the state, and it can either be general fund supported or non-general fund supported. For example, we'll be looking at veterans mortgage revenue bonds. That would be an example of a self-supporting that doesn't affect the general fund. Alternatively, a few years ago, a seismic bonds were passed for both schools and for public safety facilities. We haven't issued any of those yet. It's unclear whether that would be general fund supported, but that might be an example of where a general fund might have to come in and step in. There are direct revenue bonds. Housing revenue bonds were discussed earlier in the week, I believe, here at this committee. So you've heard about those. There's a variety of other direct revenue bonds, including transportation bonds that are self-supporting through their revenue streams. Then we have appropriation credits, which for the most part are truly general fund credits. That includes certificates of participation, as well as the appropriation deficit bonds that were done a few years ago. And lastly, we have conduit revenue bonds, which we'll be discussing in the context of House Bill 2041. These are truly conduit issues that the state of Oregon puts its name on. It doesn't have any debt service responsibilities, any ongoing management responsibilities for doing the debt management, but under federal and state law, there are a variety of different mechanisms where we issue these types of debt. This graph to my right shows you sort of very high scale, big picture, these four big categories of debt that I mentioned. What you'll notice is that about 20 years ago, most of the state's debt was general obligation, and for the most part, that was veterans mortgage revenue bonds, with a fairly small number of, relatively speaking, of course, direct revenue bonds. Over the last 20 years, you've seen a continued decline in general obligation bonds. And what you've seen is a variety of other techniques that have been used by debt managers in the state to finance a wide variety of capital and other operating expenses of state government. This just shows you the general obligation bonds. Again, the veterans portion of overall debt service and outstanding indebtedness has dropped dramatically. We have seen some increases in general obligation bonds for other programs, primarily in the area of higher education, energy. And what you see is this big chunk in 2004 and what we're forecasting for 2005, which represents the pension obligation bond sale that was done in 2003. It was structured as a general obligation credit, but used instead of for financing facilities, which is what historically had been done, general obligation bonds, or for mortgages. In this case, it was to fund the unfunded liability of PERS. I think you saw this graph the other day with Larry, when Larry was here. So I won't go over it terribly long other than to point out that besides the housing revenue bond program, which you've heard about, you can see when lottery bonds became a major new source of funding for capital projects in the state in the mid-90s. I think it started out relatively slow, but the purple, well, it looks red on your screen, it's really grown in size and scope. So the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission spends a fair amount of time looking at lottery revenue bond capacity as well as general fund bond capacity within the state because its role has grown so much. There's also highway user tax bonds. In 2000, 2001, and 2003, I believe, there's been several different authorizations by the legislature to do a variety of transportation bonds. What you see represented here is really the issuance of the bonds for OTIA 1 and 2, with the bulk of the debt issuance for OTIA 3 yet to come. So we'll see this overall chart continue to rise over time as those bonds are issued. In terms of appropriation credits, I've already mentioned COPs and appropriation bonds. That one particular issue has for the deficit bonds has a fairly short repayment structure. It's the use of tobacco revenue settlement bonds is the repayment source. So it's an appropriation credit with sort of a dedicated source that will repay it. And I believe the debt will be paid off in 2014. As you probably know, if you have a home and a mortgage, interest rates have continued to trend downwards for the last several years. I've been telling people in the business of bonds, we've been at historic lows, but I've been saying that now for about 4 or 5 years. But they really are historic lows. In fact, in the last month and a half, the longer-term interest rates have dropped yet again. We've completed a refunding fairly recently for ODOT for some existing debt that we'd issued just a year and a half or two ago. And we're going to potentially be refinancing some of the general obligation bonds for higher ed. All told, we at debt management, our job is to constantly monitor the market and take advantage of any refunding opportunity. Under federal tax law, however, for municipal bonds, you only get to do one advance refunding. So you have to pick the right moment, and then after that you have to wait to the next call that you can call these bonds. So it's called a current refunding. So we've pretty much exhausted almost every advanced refunding opportunity we have, and then the current refundings will come from time to time. All told, though, we've done five issues of refunding in 2004 to savings to the state of $14.3 million. And local governments, perhaps even better, have done 43 at savings of $47 million. All of the advanced refundings that are done in the state are reviewed by my office to make sure that they really truly are savings, because you only have that limited opportunity to refinance debt. And we want to make sure that indeed that really is a savings, that the underwriters aren't just bringing these things along and taking excessive profits, but making sure that it ends up going to the bottom line for the local jurisdictions. When the Debt Capacity Commission goes through this analysis each year and makes a recommendation to the legislature as to a prudent level of debt, they again look at this debt. It is sort of similar to the same categories I've shown you, but we look at it really from a budget perspective. So the first thing we look at is general fund supported debt that specifically has a dedicated that is specifically in the general fund. And our target or our goal, it's not a target we want to hit, but rather the most that we'd want to see it really go to is 5% of general fund revenues. It's not a magic number, but it seems like a good practice is to keep that as low as possible so that you don't end up limiting your flexibility in the general fund if there's reductions that are needed, because this becomes a very must pay once you borrow the money in terms of the state's long-term credit rating. So we want to be very careful to make sure the right things are being financed and we're not exceeding prudent limits. As I mentioned, we look at lottery-backed debt. In that case, it's a dedicated revenue stream. It's not the full general fund. It's a credit pledge. So our bond indenture says that you must have four times the revenue to the amount of debt that we issue in terms of debt service per year. So, for example, for $100 million of lottery revenue, we wouldn't be able to have debt service that exceeded $25 million per year. It's a moral obligation of the state behind that overall pledge. It was very unique when the state chose to do this type of program initially in the early 90s. It hadn't been done in the United States, and so the market felt they needed some additional assurances that that the bonds would get paid off. I think what's happened is that Florida and Oregon have led the way. The market now accepts the credit, and it's not a problem, and there's sufficient revenues, as you'll see when I show you the coverage factors, that we're in very good shape. Now, the rating agencies step back a bit, and they say, let's look at net tax-supported debt. It's more than just what your general fund is, because in some states, they may choose to put the transportation money with the general fund money, or in some states, the tobacco settlement money might be in the general fund. And so in order to compare apples to apples across 50 states, they look at everything where you could have chosen to have a tax, you know, and separate it from the things that are truly enterprise funds or truly conduits. And so I have some statistics for you in that regard. And then finally, the non-tax supported debt, the housing revenue bonds that you heard about earlier this week, don't have a generic capacity limit, but rather it's based on program revenues. And we look at each of those programs to make sure that within its own program that it is self-supporting and self-liquidating. Real briefly, these are the various bond issues and the various constitutional authorizations that we categorize in debt management for the commission as being general fund supported. I would think of some note, the pension obligation bonds that I showed you earlier, $2 billion approximately was sold in 2003. Only 38% is allocated as a debt service cost of the general fund. The balance is spread out among all the other funds because all the employees who work for the state are paid for under all the various funds in the state. And it just shows the bulk of the appropriation deficit credit and COPs, their general fund. As I've mentioned, the POBs, again, it funded an unfunded liability of PERS. We did this bond issue because we were paying to PERS for the unfunded liability of the system. We were making annual contributions. It was at a calculated actual rate of 8%. In 2003, interest rates were low enough that we were able to issue bonds at 5.75% and basically pay the same amortization stream in terms of the principal repayment, but lower that interest component by almost 2 full points. And what that does is it allowed the state to take the debt service savings from that And over time, that's estimated to be $900 million over the life of the same bonds. We didn't extend the amortization period or shorten it. We just simply matched it, the same repayment of principal pattern, and lowered the interest rates. This just shows you, again, one more way of the history of general fund supported debt. You see it bumped up substantially in 2003 due to the appropriation deficit bonds, and again with the sale of the pension obligation bonds in 2003 for the fiscal year 2004 period. The state's debt capacity target is simply a measure of you take the debt service on this debt, you divide it by sources available for repayment. We use the revenue forecast from December, and you divide one into the other to get your current ratios. Having done that, plus the debt that's already been authorized by the legislature in the previous biennium, we estimate that by the end of this fiscal year that debt ratio will be at 3.78%. Second thing we've done is we've looked forward using certain assumptions about interest rates, term of bonds, and we said neither good nor bad whether we should issue this debt, but if you wanted to go up to the maximum limit, how much additional debt capacity does the state have at this time? And the numbers on the page show you that at these maximum prudent limits, we have roughly $1 billion of remaining general fund debt capacity. In the case of lottery revenue bonds, this list just shows you some of the different programs that have been funded over the last decade for using the use of lottery revenue bonds. Primarily, they've been focused towards economic development programs.
Are those private activity bonds?
So no, they're not. In each case, these are considered public purpose.
Public purpose, okay.
And you can see the growth of the program in terms of outstanding indebtedness. It really got off the ground, I think, in 1999. And we have a fairly quick repayment on that as well. Up till the most recent sale, we've been at 15 years. So we recycle the money and freeze up those dollars for other purposes. We're going to go out to 20 years. However, because we're starting to see a limited capacity due to coverage, we forecast at the end of this year that our coverage factor, while still good at 6.5 times the amount of debt service to the amount of revenue, is starting to shrink a little. So we've been asked to look at doing 20-year bonds. The state of Florida has done that. So these numbers reflect going to a 20-year. I believe we ran the numbers, and I don't know the exact quote, but if we stated 15 years, I think it's about $90 million, give or take, unless in reduced capacity.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hass.
Thank you. Has there been much restructuring of the lottery bonds refinancing? Since, some of those earlier ones, rates were higher.
Through the chair, Representative Hass, I've been on the job 4 months.
Okay.
But my understanding is that we've taken advantage of refinancing and interest rate savings. Again, with the advanced refunding rule being, we get one bite at that apple when the opportunities have come about. The sale that we're about to price will be the first time where we've tried to go to a 20-year amortization rather than a 15-year. My guess would be that if there were higher interest rates in the early days, the people have been monitoring that at Treasury over the years to take advantage of savings when possible. But I could get back to you and guarantee that for you if you'd like.
Okay.
Thank you.
Quickly, net tax supported debt, as I mentioned, is more than just our general fund. It includes the balance of our pension obligation bonds, our lottery revenue bonds, as well as our highway user tax bonds. Using these ratios, you can see that the numbers have gone up significantly over the last few years, that our net tax-supported debt per capita and the percentage of personal income has increased substantially. At the bottom of the page, I've tried to show you what it would be like if you don't include the pension bonds. My argument would be that it was a cost to the state, either whether it's on this side of the ledger or the other side. In either case, we were making payments towards an unfunded liability. Pension bonds turned a soft liability into a bit harder liability from Wall Street's perspective. But in either case, this was a cost or a debt that we were paying. So when you take that off of the equation and you look, our debt ratios are considered low to moderate at best. And I think the rating agencies recognize that because not all states have chosen to issue pension obligation bonds. They may have the liability, but they just haven't chosen to take advantage of interest rate savings that were available in the capital markets. just lastly, you may have seen this slide. This shows you the wide array of other programs that are not tax-supported, some of which include the use of private activity bonds in order for them to issue bonds. Private activity bonds tend to be in the areas more of economic development, industrial development, revenue bonds, often used in housing, depending on the nature of the transaction, and energy.
So even though the veterans welfare bonds are for veterans and veterans housing primarily, that's a general obligation. It's not a private activity?
No, we have a federal carve-out.
Okay.
There's five states that have a special carve-out for veterans mortgage revenue bonds where it's not considered private activity.
That's how Oregon became the second largest lender in the United States of housing back a number of years ago, was under our veterans carve-out.
That's correct.
Treated as a municipal general obligation, but really was in fact a private activity.
That is why the regular housing revenue bonds that we issue that go for affordable housing require a private activity bond allocation.
Okay, fine.
Okay. In conclusion, our debt burden has increased substantially in the last few years and will continue to increase over the next few biennium as we continue to issue the bonds for the transportation program in particular. There is significant debt capacity available to meet the state's most pressing capital needs, but it is a scarce resource that we need to make sure that we allocate carefully and wisely. And we have approximately $1 billion in additional general fund supported debt that could be issued over the next 4 years and still stay within prudent limits, and approximately $571 million in lottery revenue bonds that could be issued during that same time period. And during my 4 months, as I go through each program and work with each of the different debt managers, thus far my conclusion would be that the state debt programs are managed very prudently and very carefully.
Thank you, Laura. Are there questions for Laura? And I realize some of this is repetitive of some of the issues we've gone over before, but it's an introduction to House Bill 2041. Let's see. Let's go ahead and have Kate. And thank you very much, Laura. I have Kate and Catherine come forward, please, from the Treasury and Department of Justice on 2041 as we continue the public hearing.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer. I'm here on behalf of House Bill 2041. I believe you do have testimony here before you, and I'll be offering that in just a moment. I've also brought with me Cynthia Burns from the Department of Justice, who serves as counsel to the Private Activity Bond Committee. House Bill 2041 amends the private activity bond statute and aligns it with federal law so that entities under federal law that are eligible to receive private activity bond volume cap can seek it under state law. The purpose of the private activity volume cap is to spur economic development for public benefit. The private activity bond volume cap is allocated annually by Congress to each state. Oregon's cap is allocated to the Private Activity Bond Committee, and the members of that committee are the State Treasurer by statute, or the State Treasurer, the Director of the Department of Administrative Services, and also a public member. Projects that receive some of this volume cap receive tax-exempt financing that lowers the overall cost of financing the project. And in Laura's presentation, she spoke to private activity bonds. In Oregon, a portion of the cap is designated to several state agencies, including Housing and Community Services, Economic and Community Development, Office of Energy, and Oregon Facilities Authority. The Private Activity Bond Committee allocates the remaining cap on a transaction-specific basis. The DOJ has determined, because the term governmental unit is vague in the definition of issuer, and you'll see that here in the bill before you, that Oregon statute relating to private activity bonds has the effect of being more restrictive than federal law. I wanted just to speak briefly to the removal of the reference to Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. It is called out there for it's really superfluous in the statute as it is. So in rewriting this bill, it's just making clear that any qualified applicant under federal law is eligible to apply under state law. We hope that this change to statute can prevent
falling cap from going unused, and it makes sure that we're carrying out the intent of Congress in allocating the private activity bond cap. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about this.
Cynthia, did you want to make a presentation on behalf of the Department of Justice?
Representative Butler and members of the committee, I'm basically here to answer questions on sort of the history of how this bill evolved. If you want any background on the federal law or the state law, I'd be happy to give it.
Thank you, Cynthia. Cynthia Burns, Department of Justice. Kate Richardson, Department of Treasury. Questions of any of these ladies who have made this presentation on behalf of House Bill 2041? Yes, Representative Boquist is recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I just need clarification for yourself or, I guess, the Treasurer's office. What we're really doing is just adjusting cap and allocation caps and terminology and limits. It doesn't really change bonding authority. All that still has to be go through the normal revenue process, correct?
Yes. The private activity bond volume cap is allocated from Congress to the state. The private activity bond committee is the one that's in charge, or is the entity that's in charge of allocating that at the state level. And this is aligning our state statute so that any entity that is eligible under federal law to apply for this is eligible under state law as well. So it doesn't change the volume. It just is changing our definition of who can apply for it to align with the federal intent.
Now, Kate, we do have another issuer of private bonds that we Bill Love's operation used to be the Oregon Facilities, I think is what it's called.
Oregon Facilities, Mr. Chair, yes, the Oregon Facilities Authority, and I believe in one of Laura's slides she did, that was one of the entities listed that is that receives part of the
private bond
falling cap.
Laura?
If I may add to that, they have a variety of issues that they're able to do that for higher education. They don't need one. It's only for the housing that Oregon Facilities Authority typically needs to get a private activity bond cap allocation. And each year there is part of statute where a portion of the private activity bond cap is allocated by the legislature. The balance goes to the committee, as Kate mentioned, for specific things that may come up that weren't part of a specific allocation to a department or a program.
Laura, Kate, Oregon Facilities Authority has a brochure and some other information. Can I ask that one of the two of you, both of you, bring that back to the members of the committee?
Mm-hmm.
Colleagues, I just want you to know that it's a quasi-governmental, it's actually a governmental entity in the state of Oregon that assists on private activities that has this bonding authority, and each item stands on its own. And I'm not sure what all of the things that they've been involved in, but if you've got an area in your some issue in your particular district that doesn't qualify for anything else, and yet still makes pretty good sense, the Oregon Facilities Authority is a place where you might be able to go and find a gap financing, a permanent financing at a municipal, quasi municipal rate. A very well-run ship. It's a pretty good program, and we've looked at it. I think we expanded the definitions of things they could do to take care of mental health organizations. So if you've got a mental health facility in your district that is trying to finish up a facility, build a gymnasium on an alternative school or something of that nature where you can't get other kinds of debt financing, the Oregon Facilities Authority is a place where we have that authority vested in state government. So we'll have you bring that back, if you would, so that we could have that handout. I'd like to have all of our colleagues be able to have that as a resource available so that you can service your districts with any of the questions that might come to you relative to that. It's very helpful. It's something I didn't realize existed until a few years ago, and then we got in and I said, can they build a freezer onto an Oregon Food Bank distribution center? Well, sure we can. We can do that, but we just have to have, you know, it just has to make fiscal sense. And so, but then Department of Justice said, well, let's see. Now, in reviewing all of the things they can't do, they can't put a freezer on, and we can't do some of these other things. So we came in and amended it so that they could do all of those kinds of things. And they do those kinds of things. They can bridge finance on some of those areas where you might have issues in your district. I want to be responsive to each of the members here that might have folks that come with really good programs that you can't see how it fits somewhere else, but we do have an Oregon facilities. Kate?
Mr. Chair, yes, we will be happy to provide to you some background on the Oregon Facilities Authority, and it is one of the conduit programs that Laura mentioned in her presentation, and we did expand the definition of, I think, two biennia ago to reach including education K through 12 or pre-K through 12 as well. So we'll get that to you as soon as possible.
Thank you. Other questions for, yes, Representative Boquist, recognize.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to try one more time here because I understood everything I said before. I already knew that. But so let me ask you instead of them. What we're saying, Mr. Chair, is I guess once you raise the cap, my question was, is the cap's now at this level, what entities can go out and bond and utilize this bond? And is there an approving authority in the legislature? Is there an approving authority? Or is the approving authority scattered across the whole host of agencies?
Well, my understanding, Representative Boquist, and I could be totally wrong, but there certainly is going to be nothing borrowed under any of these by any entity. An entity, of course, is that may issue the private bonds, that's going to have the authority to either receive or disperse those monies without the Ways and Means process being fully involved. So I think that's, even though we're below the cap, it's going to have to both be allocated as a receipt, and the receipt of it will have to be managed in a forum such as this, and then the disbursement, which will come through the Ways and Means process, both of which will have at least one opportunity here on the revenue and on the floor to address the expenditures of those kinds of things. So, Kate, are we close?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, maybe it'll help as a brief sort of background in how the allocation of the bond cap works. The bond cap is set, the amount of private activity bonds that we can issue is set by the federal law. And then under the federal law, either a state can decide on its own how that's further allocated, or there's a federal formula. Oregon has decided that it will decide on its own how that's allocated. And the process for that is set out in the statute that we're amending and those that follow it. And what happens is the volume cap comes to the state. The state knows generally what that number is. The legislature allocates a part of it by giving a certain amount to OFA, the Oregon Facilities Authority, a certain amount to housing, a certain amount to economic development, and then a certain amount to the Private Activity Bond Committee. And then the Private Activity Bond Committee can further allocate that to local government entities that may come before it, or to private 501c3s, for instance. Under the federal law, one of the reasons we're amending this bill is that certain types of 501c3 entities can issue qualified private activity bonds if they go through the process. Because our definition was limited to a governmental unit. Those types of entities were excluded. Now they won't be. But they will have to come to the Private Activity Bond Committee, who has been given a percentage of the state's total allocation, to further allocate as they see fit, subject to certain rules that they've adopted that mirror the standards that are set forth in the statute.
Cynthia, in that regard, then it wouldn't go through the Ways and Means process because it is private activity.
The big chunk that goes to the Private Activity Bond Committee would, but not then to the further allocation. That's at the discretion of the Private Activity Bond Committee.
And there's no good faith and credit of the state of Oregon that's on the line here.
No.
That just is activity by activity. Everything stands on its own.
Right. These are conduit bond financies. And they actually, the local government projects that come through the Private Activity Bond Committee are not State of Oregon bonds.
Right.
They would be bonds of the housing authority that issued them or the local government that issued them.
Representative Boquist, please.
We're getting close here now, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ray. And I do compliment you on your CPA speak, but I'm not a CPA, so I missed part of what you were saying, too.
I beg your pardon.
Okay, so and I don't have a problem with the cap. I'm just trying to get you to educate me here. So what we're saying is that once we raise the cap and one of these agencies has bonding authority and a good project comes along and everybody agrees it's all good and they bond, what I'm looking for, I guess, is the follow-on question, is even though this is not the good faith of the state of Oregon, if one of these entities fails, what is the impact on the credit rating in the state of Oregon, which therefore causes interest problems?
Okay. Now, let me try and take that question. That's why I was just very careful, through the chair, Representative Boquist, I was trying to very carefully break out for you the things where we do have our full faith and credit, general obligation bonds, or where we've basically pledged to appropriate appropriation bonds, Because if we fail to do it there, our credit implications are dramatic and huge. However, a conduit revenue bond, we need to review it from a due diligence perspective. Did they meet the federal tax code? Are they assuring the investors that they're going to give them ongoing information? But if they fail, it does not affect our credit rating so long as we do not have a moral obligation pledge or a legal pledge in either case to make good on that payment. It's a very different kind of a program. And no, our credit rating would not be affected. There, unfortunately, were a few instances over the last 20 years where Oregon Facility Authority transactions had run into problems. It has not affected the state credit rating. It hasn't affected OFA. However, those particular issuers would be troublesome for them to get back into the credit markets until they work out some of their financial issues.
And that's issue by issue. And
that's correct. Now,
is there more than one? Last I looked, there was only one, and it was down in Ashland on the campus, I think,
or a
museum.
Aquarium.
The aquarium. Oh, okay. All right.
And if I may add, Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, as Cynthia had highlighted, since some of these other entities are not even state entities, they're municipal or local governments or 501c3s, they're not necessarily state of Oregon bonds, so that's sort of the extra further removal from our credit rating implications.
Okay, Representative Boquist, is that right?
I don't have any problem with the issue, but I would like to see a list of who all these agencies are at some point.
You bet.
The implications really are.
I think that's probably appropriate because there are disparate groups of folks that use those where the state allocates that authority out to. And again, it doesn't affect the next project that comes through because each set of bonds is sold independently.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy with the Oregon Facilities Authority information. We'll also provide the last 5 years of private activity bond committee actions.
Okay. With that, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2041, and we'll open a work session on 2041. Colleagues, does this particular bill, thank you, Representative Haas, for requesting or at least a discussion, does this bill raise to the level of moving to the consent calendar? Any objections of discussing it in that fashion? Colleagues, in a work session, then we can go ahead and move House Bill 2041 to the floor. Sal Esquivel now moves 2041 to the floor on the consent calendar. Any objections? Hearing and seeing no objections, we will move 2041 to the full House to the consent calendar. Colleagues, I am going to open a work session. I'm going to close the work session on 2041. We're going to open a work session on 2033, the bill that we just passed. One of the vice chairs called to my attention that 2033 has a subsequent referral to the House of Labor and Consumer Affairs. You're off the hook, Representative Esquivel. Representative Esquivel now moves for a vote for reconsideration, by which we've moved to pass the 2033 to the full House. Is there any objections to the reconsideration of 2033? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We will reconsider 2033. Senator Esquivel now moves that he be able to retract his motion wherein he asked it to be moved to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, that's retracted. Colleagues, we now have 2033, which is passed the House revenue and needs to be subsequently referred to the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs by prior order of the Speaker. Is there any objections to moving it to the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We will close the public hearing on 2033.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel. I did not realize what a statesman I actually was until just now.
Great job, Sal. Now we're not going to find out all the things I did wrong. With a due pass recommendation.
That's
right?
That's
what he said.
That's
He's got
said.
It written right there.
That's what he said.
He didn't hear me. I'm sorry.
Due pass.
I heard. That's
what I heard. So this 2033 has moved to the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs with a due pass recommendation.
I know.
Any objection? Hearing and seeing none? So ordered. We are now closing for the last stinking time. House Bill 2033. May it rest in peace. Now, as we move to 2034, the Vice Chair has called to my attention that 2034 also has a subsequent referral to the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. So we will now take up 2034, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2034. Mass, would you bring us up to date on 2034, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2034 is a bill that tries to open the door, if you will, for the different government entities with the banking and the deposits to be able to chunk these deposits into different numbers of segments that allow for regulatory agencies to keep the insurance, which is capped at 100,000, but chunk it into many different banks and areas in order to allow a bigger chunk or the bigger segment of their money to be duly insured without necessarily having to have a collateral for their deposit. That's an enabling language at this time, and I think it finishes a process that started in the 2003 session. And in that sense, this is an instrument of working and banking that is being talked more about, and this has the enabling language in it. And in that sense, also, it has no revenue impact or a fiscal impact.
The questions of Mazin in that regard? We'll go ahead then with public testimony. Darren Bond. I think you have some written testimony from Darren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. Treasury brings you House Bill 2034 at the request of the local banking community. Under current law, any public funds deposits that exceed federal or private deposit insurance limits must be collateralized. This means that securities must be pledged and deposited with a custodian to provide collateral for the deposit, as a consequence reduces the funds available for the bank to make loans. House Bill 2034 will enable public funds to be deposited into certificates of deposit in amounts exceeding the $100,000 FDIC limit, but retain FDIC coverage for the entire deposit. This eliminates the need for the bank to collateralize the deposits, and it protects the public funds because they're fully insured against loss. I'll let our banking industry experts speak to the mechanics of the program, but in essence, it allows that a single large deposit to be made at a local bank, and for that deposit to be turned into multiple FDIC-insured deposits at institutions across the country. In return for placing these deposits in other institutions, the local bank gets a like amount of deposits back from those institutions. Because none of these deposits exceed the FDIC limit, the entire amount of the deposit is available for use locally and has the benefit of the security of FDIC insurance. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Darren? Let's have the bankers come forward and tell us how this is done to Rick Ruby and Tim Martinez from Oregon Bankers Association. And to convince us that we're not just parlaying money, making $1 into 10 magically in the accounts.
Would that be a bad point? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is my first time in the Revenue Committee this session, and there's a lot of new faces on this committee this time around. So you veterans are few and far between. But again, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Next to me is Rick Roby, a board member of the Oregon Bankers Association, also president and CEO of Columbia Community Bank in Hillsboro, Oregon. He will provide some testimony on the bill. And then when he finishes, we'll be happy to answer some questions. We also have in the room, if needed, the OBA Bank Counsel, Ken Sherman, Jr. I think between the three of us, we ought to be able to answer all your questions.
Ken, welcome. Or Rick, I beg your pardon.
That's right.
Rick Roby.
All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rick Roby, for the record, President and CEO of Columbia Community Bank, which is in Hillsboro, Oregon. Columbia Community Bank was formed about 6 years ago as a small business bank serving the business banking needs of the businesses in Washington County. We presently have four offices that serve Forest Grove, Hillsborough, Beaverton, and Tigard, and currently have assets of $138 million, which in banking terms is considered a small community bank. Our primary customer base is real estate construction, owner-occupied real estate, acquisition loans, and operating and manufacturing and professional business loans. Our employees have strong ties in our local community, as do I. I am currently the chairman of the board of the local Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, and also an active member of the Oregon Bankers Association. And today I'm representing the Oregon Bankers Association at this hearing in support of House Bill 2034. House Bill 2034 is introduced by Treasurer Randall Edwards, and if enacted, would provide Oregon banks with a new tool and greater flexibility in the area of public deposits. Simply put, House Bill 2034 would allow Oregon banks to participate in a national program called Certificate of Deposit Account Registry Services, also known by the acronym CDERS. This program provides for public deposits exceeding the federal deposit insurance limits to be initially deposited in an Oregon bank and then redeposited the excess in certificates of deposits with other financial institutions that are also CDERS participants, and then deposits corresponding amounts back into the Oregon bank.
So, Rick, let me just make sure I understand how it works. Basically, the same $1 million deposit divided up 10 ways. One stays with the local bank and has the FDIC CD capacity there.
Correct.
The other nine then stay with the local bank on a reciprocal arrangement where you're issuing CDs, insured $100,000 CDs, nine of them, on behalf of the other banks, which you have a cross borrowing arrangement with those folks. So they're doing the same thing in their community that you're doing in yours. They're issuing one of your CDs from the Columbia Community Bank for one of those 100,000, even though it might be in Columbia, North Carolina.
Correct.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Please proceed.
That process that you just described is called a net settlement, where we actually, the important part of this bill is that we actually still control those deposits and our customers at a local level. So we're not sending control of those deposits. We're not actually sending deposits that we're not getting reciprocal CDs to another area. The local relationship.
Who brokers all of that relationship, Rick?
The company was started by a couple of gentlemen by the name of William Seidman, who was the former FDIC chairman, and Charles Ludwig, the former comptroller of the currency. So they've been around for a while and know the regulatory field and have put this program together, and that's why we felt comfortable with getting involved in the program. Passage of House Bill 2034 would provide banks like mine with a greater flexibility in accepting funds by reducing paperwork and therefore by reducing the cost of taking those types of deposits. Currently, we're forced to invest in government-grade, lower-yielding securities to be able to pledge those for public funds. This would allow us to save that money and reinvest those funds rather than in low-yielding government bonds to the local community, to our customers, provide more housing and business growth for our local communities. That would be across the state. Equally important, public entities will have increased protection for their public funds as they would be insured up to the FDIC limit of $100,000 for each of their deposits. Currently, that would allow our individual community banks or individual community institutions to take deposits up to $10 million per institution. So it's for a small community bank like mine and many across the state, this is a very important bill for us to be able to get that funding that we need to put back into the business community. The CDERS program is currently successfully operating in several states. We are currently using the program not necessarily for public funds, but for large depositors in our community right now. It's working very well. And I want to thank the Treasurer's Office for for bringing this legislation to you, and if they hadn't, we at the Oregon Bankers Association probably would. So we're in support and with the treasurer's office, and I'd like to thank you for your pointed questions earlier, and invite you to ask any questions that you may have at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Roby. Are there questions for Tim Martinez, Mr. Roby, or Darren? Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you. Gentlemen, this program, you've been doing this with other deposits, but not public. Is that what's different here? Is the Treasury is coming in and saying you can do this program with public deposits? Is that?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, that's correct. We need a statutory change to do it with public funds. You can do it with private deposits now.
And this is a practicing banking that's been going on. I mean,
it hasn't been going on for eons. No. It's a program that was put together by William Seidman, former chairman of the FDIC, and Charles Ludwig, and it's been in functioning for two or three years.
So it's sort of a function of the internet.
No, it's not. It's not internet deposits, but there's something
going on. Not internet. The ability this seems like a very complicated business of keeping track where all these deposits go. It's countrywide, is it not?
That's why we have the company from the regulators was formed by regulators. They do all the work of taking the money in, doing the accounting.
And that gets to my question: who is doing that? There's a broker that does all this accounting of how this works?
I would be more than happy to give you the name of the company. I didn't bring it.
But that's how it works. Today. There's a company that manages this.
Correct.
On behalf of Cedars and your bank. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm seeing this moving around, and I'm trying to figure out who's managing it.
Well, internet deposits are much different than what this product is.
Well, I guess my question, my comment about the internet is that things are moving a lot faster through this world because of the internet than they would have in the old days when banks were carefully carrying pieces of paper between them. I guess that was my reference to the internet, not...
Yeah.
Okay.
This process is done through the Federal Reserve System on a wiring basis and not on the internet,
if you will.
So it's going through the regular, normal banking process to transfer funds from one place to another.
Sometimes things move a little fast for those of us who remember when pieces of paper went.
Representative Gilchrist?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in support of this, but I still have some questions. Could you comment, I mean, in your testimony, you're talking about countrywide, and we're down to 3 to 4 years this has been going on, and mind you, open testimony, my company does this sort of thing too, so
right. Just
to cover deposits and things like that. So I understand the basic concept of how it works. But what I'd like you to comment on is three things. The first thing I'd looking for comment on is your written testimony says successfully in several states. That's several states. I'd like to have several states define how broad scoping is this as this trend starts through. The second thing is, what is the, and this probably Tim can answer this one, what's the general consensus of existing FDIC board members, or is the FDIC given some leaning one way or the other, this is okay, this is not okay? Because there's two lawyers on each side of the court here, so one might win, one might lose. And the third question is you did mention the utilization of the Federal Reserve, and I understand international wire banking, so on and so forth, but as the Federal Reserve actually, for example, the bank in Portland or San Francisco, taking kind of a position on this type of activity? Thank you. Three questions.
Okay.
You take the first and third, I'll take the second.
The states involved, I'd be more than happy to get back with you. And, you know, as far as I would know, it would be all the states in the union have access to this program. I can get that information. I'd be more than happy to provide it to the chairman and to the committee.
Any other two questions?
I'll take number two, Mr. Chair, Representative Buckwitz. You know, in some states like Oregon, you need some legislation to make this work. It's my understanding that the folks behind Cedars, again, the former FDIC chair and the OCC controller of the currency, both intend to grow this business as best they can nationwide under existing state laws. As far as the regulators are concerned, they have taken a look at this and are supportive. I think it's indicative indicative today that this bill is brought to you by the Oregon State Treasurer. Mm-hmm. Having dealt with Mr. Bond over the years on collateralization of public fund deposits, I can assure you he is not a liberal on the public's dollars. He very much is very careful in what he's willing to do. So I think it really speaks a lot, and we again thank the Treasurer for moving forward on this.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Boquist, the FDIC has blessed the program. Previously, it was at a $5 million maximum amount, and they just recently upped that to allow deposits of up to $10 million to have the conduit FDIC insurance through a program like this. And to Representative Berger's point earlier, if I might, Mr. Chair, from the local government perspective, they're getting everything from Columbia Community Bank. They're not having to get reports from 10 different or 9 different other institutions around the country. It's all centralized through their local institution. They work with their local banker. They get the benefit of the FDIC insurance with none of the headache of having to place those deposits at all the multiple institutions. What this law is allowing us to do primarily is that it's easing the restriction on local government money in terms of being able to deposit outside of Oregon. Currently, our public funds depository statutes restrict where they can deposit money to depositories in Oregon. Because of the reciprocal nature of the program, we felt that it was appropriate in this instance to allow that exemption.
And here all this time you thought that local governments didn't have any money.
And Mr. Chair, if I could make one final comment, Rick mentioned it, but I just want to reinforce it. The major item that this allows Oregon banks to do is to invest more in their community, because at the end of the day, they'll have more funds to be able to invest in housing and commercial and other loans.
In that regard, if the CDRS program were opened up to include credit unions, and credit unions could participate in this, then credit unions could take, assuming state law provided that there was a method for them to do it, credit unions could take up to $10 million under this arrangement, too, if they could participate in the CDRS program.
Mr. Chairman, currently the CDRS program is limited to banks.
I realize that, but if Oregon law and the CDRS program was opened up, then our small credit unions and small communities where we may not have the banking access. But of course, if all of the banks in Oregon are doing this, then maybe the credit unions wouldn't be needed. But in the past, we've had to have money spread around to the banks in and around the communities. Is this something that might be available to them at some particular point in time, or are there enough banks in Oregon that are participating in this that in Vail, Oregon, they can take the receipts and move them over to the one or two banks that are in town?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very loaded question. I don't know if the Treasurer has an answer for that or not, but I also know that Ms. Levitt is in the room and would be happy to represent the credit unions on this issue.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the language as written should there be a program of a similar nature that a credit union could participate in, I believe the language as written would allow for that.
Okay, thank you. Okay. The chair recognizes Representative Riley.
Yeah, I don't really have a question. I just wanted to tell Rick that I'm sorry I can't come to the chamber meetings. I'm kind of busy. we're in the same chamber of commerce. So.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, before you close the hearing, we did visit with Chair Brown today, and I don't know what the protocol is this session for subsequent referrals, but I believe this bill does have a subsequent referral to business. I don't know if you have the authority to remove that or whether we need to go through the speaker, but Chair Brown is certainly very supportive of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tim. Right now there is the subsequent referral, and I think we'll go ahead and honor that at this particular point, and in the future if we want to go ahead and seek that, we can get a letter from Mother. Any other questions of the three participants, presenters today? Thank you very kindly. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2034, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2034. Representative Estevez.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2034 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to refer it to the Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. And let me again reiterate on that. I move that we move it to refer it to Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs.
With a due pass
recommendation.
By prior appointment of the bill, subsequent referral to Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs, Representative Esquivel now moves House Bill 2034 to the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I personally would like to see that when it is, of course, referred and passed, and I do support it, that at least the comments and the concerns we had regarding potential future expansion to community banks be included in the notes given to the committee.
To the credit unions?
To the credit unions.
Thank you. So noted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other discussion? Other objections? Are there any objections to the motion made by Representative Esquivel? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2034 moves to the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee in the House with a due pass recommendation. Colleagues, just remind you that tomorrow we do have a meeting over at the... yes?
Before moving on, we need to close the work session.
You're absolutely right. Closed.
Yeah, it'd be Christy.
Thought we did that one. That was a stinking thing.
You did, Mr. Chairman. We know you did.
Okay. All right. Just by way of reminder, tomorrow, Representative Boquist, give us an update on the activity that you'll be meeting with relative to the meeting with the county commissions.
We're now meeting with four county commissioners. Correct me if I'm wrong, colleagues. I believe the Democrats today met with some of the county commissioners at noon. I believe that's correct.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And that same opportunity to meet with your elected county officials and learn about joint state county services will be from 12:15 to 12:45 tomorrow for those member Republicans that are not attending this committee's event across the way. All of the rest of the Republicans have been invited with emphasis from the majority leader to attend this meeting so that we can all be on the same breadth and scope of music on the joint services. So any colleagues on the Republican side that you see that aren't going to this event, I would encourage you to attend the event from 12:15 to 12:45. And those Republicans you know that are not going to attend that, please refer them to one of the Democrats that did attend so they can...
Now, Representative Boquist, our Democratic members would like to attend your meeting tomorrow, are they invited?
If they would like, they may come.
Thank you. Because I think probably more at the city and county level locally, they don't recognize the DRR behind our name.
That's right.
That's probably a phenomenon that's limited to the building here. So with that, and then tomorrow at noon, we'll go ahead and also be invited. Graciously, we've been invited to the over to the local government's building across the tracks and on the... let's see, that's the north side, I guess. We're invited to go over and have lunch with them, meeting with our county commissioner, our city folks, and then at 1 o'clock the city folks, and at 2 o'clock the county folks, and we'll be done by 3 o'clock, should be back here in the building. Invite you all to participate and attend with us. You'll be meeting some of your colleagues there, as well as your constituents and people who... represent local governments, which are an important partner for us as we continue forward in the work of the House Revenue. Colleagues, we do have schedules available, and we're receiving those through Kim James of our agenda for next week. We're going to start, as soon as I learn the parliamentary procedure on how to open and close a work session, we're going to start working through some bills. And so I encourage you to as much as you possibly can be here at the 1:30 time, and then as this starts to move fairly rapidly, we'll go ahead and speed this up and probably move back to a 1 o'clock opening time. So with that, and former Senator Esquivel will watch the House time. With that, colleagues, we'll stand adjourned. and hope to see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now I know.